This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. In June of 2008, I heard from the poet F.D. Reeve that he was in Northern California visiting from his home in Vermont. My live poetry series, the Word Temple poetry series, was already booked for the evening. He was available and was to feature Susan Kelly DeWitt and Albert Flynn DeSilver. Fortunately, these two poets agreed to forfeit a little of their own reading time so Reeve could also read. Everyone was glad it turned out that way. Thankfully, I also scheduled a radio interview with him. He had such an interesting life, a celebrated and award-winning poet, fiction writer, nonfiction writer, translator, critic, father of the late actor Christopher Reeve, and instructor of Russian language and literature. Reeve even accompanied Robert Frost to Russia for his meeting with Nikita Khrushchev in 1962 as his translator. So over the years, we stayed in touch, and he always sent his latest poetry books, even when he and his wife, the novelist Laura Stevenson, had no plans on visiting California. On June 28, 2013, I was greatly saddened to hear that Reeve had died that day from complications of diabetes. Unbelievably, he was 84 years old. It is difficult to think of someone with so much energy just not being here anymore. He was a terrific poet and such a nice person on top of it that he made quite an impact here in Northern California. And so I'm sure he did everywhere he went. Tonight's program is a tribute to F.D. Reeve. I'll air the interview with him that I recorded back in 2008 and then play a portion of the remaining program that had to do with Hurricane Katrina and a book of poems that he wrote an introduction for about Hurricane Katrina, a collection of poems. So let's move on now to the interview. Here is F.D. Reeve, and you'll also hear some cuts from his CD, The Blue Cat Walks the Earth, his poetry sent to jazz. This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guest tonight is F.D. Reeve. He's the author of 9 books of poetry, including The Blue Cat, The Return of the Blue Cat, The Blue Cat Walks the Earth, and his latest collection, The Toy Soldier. I've also been enjoying a CD of Reeve reading his poems from The Blue Cat Walks the Earth, along with some pretty terrific jazz accompaniment. Reeve has published 7 books of fiction, as well as essays, reviews, etc., and he wrote the preface for the anthology For New Orleans and Other Poems, a book we'll return to later in this show. F.D. Reeve, welcome.
Hi, Catherine. It's very pleasant to be here. It's a lovely evening in California, and it's a very nice presence to be together and discussing poetry.
Well, thanks for coming all the way to Santa Rosa. We really appreciate it. Before we get to your poetry, which we will soon, it's not every day I sit with someone who was a friend of Robert Frost. You traveled to the Soviet Union with him as his personal translator and wrote a book about that experience, didn't you?
It's wonderful. That comes out as a conclusion, but it was nice. We agreed at the time that we weren't ever going to write. I agreed with, first it was Mr. Frost when I first met him, but after a one-night flight across the Atlantic, it was Franklin and Robert. And we agreed that we weren't going to write anything about it. But then his unexpected or his sudden death, an unexpected death in the January after the trip, persuaded Kathleen Morrison, his secretary, Kay Morrison, to get me to write the book. So that's why I wrote it.
So is that how your friendship started, was this trip to the Soviet Union?
Yeah, right. But the interesting part is that I didn't want to go at all. I said, no, that I'm not going to go because I don't want to be a tour guide if that's all he's going to do. And so I had been in Russia the year before. Uh-huh. I had spent my chance to get there on an exchange with the academy. But I'd been there for a year. And I said, no, the only point in my going is to do something good for Mr. Frost, which would be to get him to meet some of the literary people that I had met in the previous year. Uh-huh. And after he agreed to that, I said, okay.
Great.
So he sort of got pushed around just a little bit more than he had first thought he would. And he took to it very nicely. Because he wanted to go and see Mr. K. That was the whole point.
Uh-huh.
That was his idea.
Well, there was a newspaper article from Middlebury, Vermont, on, what is the date of June 2nd. I'm going to read the first two sentences of this article. It has to do with how Robert Frost's home was vandalized recently.
Right.
And this is what the article says. Call it poetic justice. More than two dozen young people who broke into Robert Frost's former home for a beer party and trashed the place are being required to take classes in his poetry as part of their punishment. Using the road not taken and another poem as jumping off points, Frost biographer Jay Perini hopes to show the vandals the error of their ways and the redemptive power of poetry. Poetry is punishment. What do you think of this?
Yeah. Well, apparently the prosecutor called up Jay and asked him if he would do it, and Jay agreed. Poetry is punishment. God knows how much good it will do. I don't think Frost would have agreed to it at all. He'd have said, right, you know, spank the scoundrels and let's go on.
Right. I almost died when I read that myself.
Exactly.
Oh. Well, you include a number of poems translated from Russian in The Toy Soldier. And how is it that you're fluent in Russian? And would you say something to me in Russian?
Могу. Дело в том, что просто хотел сказать, что я, как сказать, я влюбился в язык. И просто этот язык меня просто очаровал с самого начала. И я вот просто следил.
And what does that mean?
That I was...
or do I want to know?
Yes, I was captivated by the language and the possibility of it. My first acquaintance with things really seriously Russian was an interpretation and understanding of the Russian novels, the big novels, by Blackmer, R.P. Blackmer, in college. I didn't know any Russian then at all. But I followed the care and the affection with which he approached and discussed and understood and explained and elucidated the works. And that took me into another world. So then I learned the language.
Yeah, very good. Not an easy language to learn, I'm sure.
I think it's easier probably than Chinese and Japanese, which I don't know at all. So I think there are harder things.
A different key. Music in a different key, yeah. Well, let's turn to your latest collection of poems, The Toy Soldier. It is a very interesting book of poems, really, really beautiful. And it opens up with a lovely example of Ecrasis, a stunning poem called Fra Angelico's Annunciation. Would you read that poem?
Can I just say a couple of words first?
Absolutely.
Imagine yourself in Florence. You're going to the monastery, San Marco Monastery, where Angelico was one of the brothers. You go into the ground floor, you go around and you go up the stairs to what would be the first floor, or what we would think of as the second floor in American terms. And as you walk up the stairs, the painting is right in front of you. So it reveals itself to you the way if you bicycle to Chartres, for example, from the north, the cathedral rises above the ground as you slowly approach the city. And the same thing happens with this painting. There's also a little reference. There's an epigraph, Ars ex arte orator, or art proceeds from art, which is attributed to Cimabue, who was a painter before, the century before Fra Angelico. And it's interesting because it emphasizes, despite the importance and the reliance of the painting on faith or on what you might call some kind of a philosophical reading, it's saying that art actually is the cause of art. Fra Angelico's Annunciation. In Florence, Cimabue was the first to paint words in gilt on his sacred illustrations of imaginary events and metaphoric lust. The Republic itself was young. There were no nations. People defined themselves by dialect and place. Local languages were thought adequate for local sensations. Suddenly, at the top of the stairs, two figures of the High Renaissance, he kneeling, pushing the air as if it were information, she seated, incredulous, as if already bearing a sacrifice. Neither moves. For a moment, the passion terrifies. Then life, like the dulcet Ave Maria, now invisible on the gold air, resumes its small-town provocations. Each holds the other in the old belief. A warm light spreads over the fields of uneasy fantasies. When she completes her part, she too will be released. Nothing heard, nothing to hear. Deafness shines in their faces. His young body carries the news of divine love's elegance, and her beautiful figure heralds 1,000 years of grace.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In this book, there are some really deeply moving poems where a father figure appears. There are the Russian translations. There are all kinds of poems. How did you decide on the structure for this book?
Books are, unless you write a long poem, as you know, which is sort of one whole composite, even if it has smaller pieces in it, it's one general idea, it's one basic structure. Say a poem of, say, 20 or 30 or 40 pages. Your poems are written sort of piece by piece. And suddenly after 2 or 3 or 4 years or whatever, you say, wait a minute, that's enough poems to make a kind of statement. And I was pleased by this collection because of the variety that I was able to introduce into it. Because it seems to me that one of the things that often happens to people is they keep writing sort of in the same groove on the same record.
Yes.
And yes. I think just as a very wonderful Russian novel, say, has all kinds of colors and characters in it. So a book of poems that has a real variety.
Yeah. We get to feel all kinds of things in this book.
It will mean more.
Yes.
Right. So there is a group of poems. Uh-huh. There's some poems about the war. There's some about translations. There's some about things in general. But there's this mention that you, about so-called my father, is a group of 12 poems, which, like anything else, is partly true and full of falsehoods, full of all kind of imaginings. Nobody ever tells the truth. And poets never tell the truth, do we really?
No, what is the truth?
Exactly.
So that's another hour-long show.
Well, as Melville said, if you want the truth, you go to the soup societies.
Well, there's a section in the book called The Blue Boat on the St. Anne.
Yes.
And I was hoping you'd read the first two poems from that section, The Blue Boat on the St. Anne and The Lover.
Glad to. They're both... They're about my father as I can reimagine or reconstruct or reconstrue or rebuild or refancy my father. The Blue Boat on the St. Anne is actually the title of a watercolor that he gave me. I guess it's actually his widow gave me, who is now his widow, gave it to me. I picked it up at the time he was dying. He died about 20 years ago. But it is a painting of a tall man out in a blue canoe with a guide, salmon fishing, on the river called the St. Anne. So I have used that as a reconstruction of him.
Wonderful.
And there's only one thing in it that may be a little problem to a listener, and that is where it talks about nuns and cans. They're the markers for courses for boats on the water.
Oh.
On the rivers or on the seas or something like that. So the nun is a red and the can used to be black, it's now green. But it sort of marks the channels.
The nun has changed her habit.
Very much so, right? So no wimples.
Okay.
The Blue Boat on the St. Anne. I painted my father in as pilot of my model plane. One day it stalled at the top of an Immelmann, then plunged like a kingfisher into Silver Lake. I picked the pieces up by boat. A flawed design, a deceptive wind, my desire seemed the worst mistake. His death in plastic lasted years while I grew older in a dream world where he was hero. I longed to have his medals, his women, and his smile. Hot, inconsolable nights, I dived head over heels into the past to be steered by his hands and to take on his style. Divorced. Remarried. Like leaves, the words floated downstream in the dark. He, in a new life, was rich and loved. My God, drowned in the summer twilight. Falling asleep miles away, I remembered his hat above the horizon, making the bats curve in the sky. Life, once as bright as the sun-filled meadow scented with chamomile we used to cross to get to where the good fishing was, became unbridgeable winter days. He didn't care who I was, and I retaliated. We were dead on each other. Memory began to flatten his face. One autumn I recalled his mortality, sent him a letter. He sent me the watercolor of a boat like one that for 40 years he had fished for salmon from, sturdy enough for 2 heavy men, their rods and gear, as far into the north woods as they wished. Because the soul after death departs its suffering, like lightning arcing across the sky from nothing to nothing along the channels of electromagnetic nuns and cans. His spirit, wearing his hat, lights up what's left of our small future together, fishing from the blue boat on the St. Anne. The Lover. Women called him romantic, my old man. 5 lady-killing fingers on each hand, lips thin but sweet like honey, enchanting eyes that swiftly crowned each surmise with pleasure. Do you miss him, fair ladies? The last one, who alone held his heart and memorized his hands, he's her man forever. Spring now. The Shadbury's out. The river recedes, but nothing of his fine body remains, as if by invisible mending he wove himself into love.
Your poems, if not in actual form, often at least appear to be. Do you make up forms, and is this to help you move forward in writing the poem, or is it purely for aesthetic reasons?
There are a number of things. First of all, I feel very important that good poetry, poetry we really care about, has an underlying rhythm, which you can perceive, which you feel, which simply is there, the way good jazz has rhythm. It really good stuff, look at it wherever it is, there's a basic rhythm. And very often it can't be enhanced by rhyme, which many people try, simply because English has become very parsimonious. It's really outworn. English rhyme is worn out. It was wonderful 400, 300, 200 years ago. But it's very, very difficult to do. And rhyme tends to make something light or irrelevant or fun or jokey or something. So it's fine, wonderful rhyme. Once in a while, you can get a poem that is perfectly and fully rhymed, but not usually. So I've tried to go around it, tried to find different ways, half rhymes, slant rhymes. And one of the ways, for example, a number of things I've done and it seems successful is to use the same word as end word, line, ends of lines in different successive stanzas. So you get a three stanza poem, say, of 8 lines each, and each line ends in the same word, which finally you sort of unconsciously keep hearing the words again, and it has the function of rhyme.
Absolutely. Interesting. So, well, before we move on, how about 2 more poems from the section, The Blue Boat on St. Anne? The title poem of the book, The Toy Soldier, and then Fieldstones.
Okay. I don't know where The Toy Soldier came from. It was just an idea. It began, I can remember it beginning as a poem with the final image, the closing image. And the poem was actually written to the last line. That doesn't often, as you know, that doesn't often happen. You have to be sort of lucky to have that happen. And it did. And that's how, and of course, dealing with the father, the Hamlet reference comes crashing smooth, right? The Toy Soldier. Abstract, half false, to be or not to be. My life gains stature as my father dies, first sinking like the heavy moon each morning, then like starry Orion, climbing the sky with golden eyelids, my tunic turned to diamonds, my steel sword stiffening my thigh. Death is no model. Father and anti-father annihilate each other in summer air. Selves and anti-selves that no one thought of burn up like meteor showers. Everywhere time skips out of measure, hardly noticed, and space is neither here nor there. Turned out in the heavens like a sheep to pasture, I'll make my place the center by making maps. So what if the sun burns up? I'll hear antimatter collide with matter, smell the lightning and the thunder clap. The universe is paper, and I'll stand on it like a toy soldier on the Russian steppe. And very different in tone is the next one. Here we are in California, but imagine you're back in a rocky Vermont pasture.
I can do that.
Okay, there we are. Fieldstones. Two boulders on the hill lie scorched by the sun. Markers, my neighbor calls them, who follows the cow path into the woods above the pasture, looking for the Indian burying ground, not asking how they got there. Long after the glacier melted and the lake dried, field flowers ring them like medieval tombs, as if my father's granite body were Duke of the Air, with his blonde duchess embossed on the grass. All winter snow covers their faces. In spring, the runoff trickles behind their ears while the sap rises, the little leaves start, orioles sing in the orchard, and their children make love between their bones.
As a way of transitioning to another section of your book, I'm going to quote William Carlos Williams. It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. And of course, that's from Asphodel, that greeny flower. In one section of The Toy Soldier, The Causes of War, you have a series of seven poems, each one referring to a different cause. For instance, indifferent, vanity, violence. These aren't the usual anti-war rants that you might expect to find, and I was pleasantly surprised to find that when I read these poems. The poems approach the subject from different angles, and they're just really lovely. Would you read a few of them? Maybe Vanity, Lust, and Greed.
Yes, and thank you. Yes, what I very much wanted to do in the series was to take a rather common vice, a rather well-known, a rather, you could even say, an exaggerated vice, and who presented in its most mundane, ordinary, sort of secret way. Because insofar as things happen ordinarily, we don't suspect them. We don't even understand them as vice or virtue. And I wanted it to be, as it were, almost invisible and to sort of seep through the waves. The water will seep through some cloth, or all of a sudden a stain will appear on the other side of the blotter. And then you can see that that kind of attitude, say this whole notion of vanity, allows the pomposity, the arrogance, and finally the terrible invasions. All right, let me read Vanity and see if that works. Vanity. The ocean is a universe expanding in all directions from this island where I stand on a long point of ledge. Tidewater pools in the crevices. Shiners and crabs swim the pools. Gulls pick the sand. The earth seesaws from edge to edge at this patient hour of peace. The daylight cools. The distant mountains, as blue as classical Tuscan hills, gather the vanishing light. So I remember the green mountains in childhood, when I used to dream of striding from peak to peak, heel to toe, against my father's will, across the top of our yard, down the spine of the broken world.
This is really, this is one of the poems that I wish that our listeners could see. Go get the book, The Toy Soldier. But you have that half line, the earth seesaws from edge to edge. And that's exactly what the form of this poem is doing. You have half a line far to the left, half a line far to the right. It seesaws continuously through the poem. It's just wonderful.
Well, it's very wonderful that you see that, because it's a great reward. It's a great reward to want to do something, to try to do something and have someone catch it and to respond. I feel very lucky. This is Crazy Jane is from the, well, first of all, I'll say Willie is W.B. Yeats, and Crazy Jane are the Crazy Jane poems. So this is playing with the images that Yeats made in the Crazy Jane poems, the wild one. The point being, of course, that there's a huge distinction between the passion that drives love and the madness that drives lust.
And the name of this poem is Lust.
Right. Well, it's lust that gets into war. I mean, it's a lust.
Mm-hmm. We're still talking about the causes of war.
The causes of war. Yes. These three poems are the causes of war. And lust is one of the causes of war. Each month under the swelling moon, Crazy Jane went wild for Willie, his money, his patrician name, herself the cynosure of fairy. Nothing in life is ever lost. The passionate heart presumes a story. Love springs forward like a broken hand swinging on the porcelain face of a clock. The flag on the moon flaps for each electric phase. Nothing in life is ever lost. The passionate heart demands a story. Night offers no rest. Men ride the solar wind from moon to moon to galloping triumph. Like a dream, the springtide brings in the winner's name. Nothing in life is ever lost. The passionate heart pounds out a story.
And those lines, nothing in life is ever lost. The passionate heart resumes a story. Those are Yeats?
No, that's mine.
Those are yours.
Yeah.
Because they're italicized, I wondered.
So I simply put them there so to take them outside, to make it very clear that they're commentary without being a refrain as such, that it's a kind of refrain. And I wanted very much to de-romanticize the poem. I don't know whether that works that way or not. But that was the idea, even by, because usually if you have a kind of refrain, it becomes sort of a romantic song, becomes, that's with the song, it becomes sort of the chorus.
Yes.
And
yes.
I meant it to be an anti-chorus or a hostile mm-hmm. chorus or an annoying chorus in that sense.
I don't know if
right.
I was annoyed by them, but yes.
And you see, I mean, I forgot to say also, of course, when I say each electric phase, electricity works in phases.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
people, it comes that way. That's alternating current comes
right,
in phases.
Right. Okay. Yes. Okay. And now we have greed.
It's funny. I don't know how we're having a very pleasant time chatting with you. I did have a great aunt named Alice. And great aunt Alice had a music box. That is true. That was there. And the line in their autumn beauty, of course, is Yeats's line. Nobody waits for the fall. I should say autumn. The link to other languages in the family. But that seems antiquated, like Aunt Alice, who wore a choker with a cameo of her mother, and every evening played the music box as big as a trunk in the living room by bay window. She knew when the trees were in their autumn beauty, but she had forgot who told her. The world she walked in, house by house on autumn afternoons down an elm-lined street, fell with her family of majestic trees and the nobility of Europe. Alice was a lady, friends and neighbors said, like her mother. The house was sold, the pathways and the box torn up. Solar panels replaced her window. Old men lamented the passing of her beauty, though none had ever loved her. Now, past the Virgin, we have come to autumn again. The street is patrolled by a different family. In the cold nights of despair, we imagine Alice, a saint in blue, as pure as the Holy Mother, impatient to have our sacrifices box after box, like Christmas presents. In the window of heaven, the world parades her everlasting beauty, and the men who kill to get her. You might also notice that's the one in which, of the three stanzas, the end words are all the same.
Before I move on to the anthology, which I want to do real soon, would you like to choose one of the five poems that you translated from the Russian to read?
The one that's most fun to hear, the Snorters, I think, is one I like most. Also, the Akhmatova is terribly nice. What about the Akhmatova? Can we read that?
Absolutely.
All right. She was really a grande dame. Have you ever followed something of her biography? She was a very, very naughty young woman. She was very naughty. She was absolutely ravishing, terribly bright, very talented, very beautiful, and loved the attentions that she got very deservedly. Right. So it's certainly one young man wiped himself out over frustration for not being her lover. But she married, she had a baby with Kumilyov, and she let her parents bring it up. I mean, she was just having too good a time in the period before the First World War, being in the bohemian world of all the poets and very, very successful. And then her life turned very bitter because Gumilyov was accused. Well, he was anti-Soviet, and he was punished for it. And the son himself, much later, was imprisoned because of it. And she felt extremely guilty for that. Mm-hmm. This was her fault. Also, in that whole period, first of all in the 30s, but then again in the 40s and 50s, after the Zhdanov period, she hardly had any living. She became an old and very poor person, hugely admired, and had very fine, very dear, very important friends.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You're listening to F.D. Reeve. This is from an interview I recorded with him in June of 2008. He passed away on June 28th of 2013, and this is a tribute show for him. Let's return now to F.D. Reeve.
She also had an interesting, I'll just say one more, couple of quick things. She was very cooperative and very polite to Frost, who was amazingly, amazingly rude to her.
Oh, my.
Because, well, he wasn't actually insulting, but he was extremely stupid and indifferent because the competition was clear too much for him. Because they both were up for the Nobel Prize that year.
Oh, no.
Right. And, of course, it didn't go to either one of them. It went to Steinbeck. But it was... Oh. It was that kind of thing. So that this poem, which she read when Frost and she were together. I had met her the year before and arranged this meeting with Mikhail Alexeyev. The lovely day, lovely time. She was fine. I liked her enormously. I liked Akhmatova a great deal and, of course, admired her work. And again, I tell you, poets are wonderful. We can't tell the truth. She said to Frost that she'd written the poem the day before and she recited it. She hadn't written it the day before. She'd written it about 3 months before.
Oh, details.
Exactly. The hell with the details. It doesn't matter. That's right. That's right. Anyway, there she was and she read it. And this is the poem. Morozova was a 17th century old believer, schismatic. Her stepmother, Dido, and Joan is Joan of Arc. Mm-hmm. It's called The Last Rose. I bend my head when Morozova bows in prayer. I dance with Herod's stepdaughter, Salome. I fly up in the smoke from Dido's fire to be with Joan again at her auto da fe. Oh, Lord, you see, I am too tired to be resurrected more or made to die or live. Take everything away, but let me feel anew the freshness of this bright red rose. She lived for that. She really meant that.
Yes.
And it came across in all her conversations and in her best poetry.
I'm happy to hear you talk about how she led kind of a wild life at one point, too,
wow.
Because all of the depictions that I've seen in her in film and so on have shown this bleak life with the loss of the husband, the loss of the son.
She certainly suffered very much under Soviet repression. There's no question about that. But before that, no, she had a wild, wonderful bohemian life. And even in the days when things were very hard and very heavy, she had some very fine and loyal friends. So she was supported. She didn't live in the heart of a happy bourgeois family, but she wouldn't have tolerated that anyway. And she was, in a very, very real sense, because of her intelligence and her strength and because of the literary support and respect that she'd had all her life, she was a grande dame. And there'd be no question, if you're trying to go through the door at the same time, who'd go first?
Yeah. Sorry, Robert Frost.
That's right. You got it.
Well, let's move on to the anthology for New Orleans and Other Poems, for which you wrote the preface and you have a poem in there that we'll get to in a little bit. The title of the anthology is the name of a haiku in the book written by Oakland, California poet Adele Foley. Well, before I knew you'd be coming to Santa Rosa, you recorded the preface for me. And it's really a remarkable preface because it accomplishes its intent to keep us focused on the continuing problems that the survivors of Hurricane Katrina are still facing. I'm going to play the preface right after Joe McGee sings When the Levee Breaks. This is from the Mississippi Blues Rare Cuts 1926 to 1941 album.
Levee keeps on raining, levee's going to break. And the water gonna come, I have no place to stay.
Well, all that night I sat on a lever and moaned. Well, all that night I sat on a lever and moaned, thinking about my baby and my happy home. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. And all these people have no place to stay. Now look here, mama, what am I to do? Now look here, mama, what am I to do? I ain't got nobody to get my trouble to. I works on the levee, mama, both night and day. I works on the levee, mama, both night and day. I ain't got nobody to keep the water away.
The good people of New Orleans, who grew up on folk tales and festivals, suppose that the fable of Canute didn't apply to them, that the force of a hurricane lay beyond human comprehension, or that the Gulf would never rise against them. This little book is a tribute to their faith in their city and their lives. It honors the courage and integrity of all who suffered through the storm and returned or remained to rebuild. While it celebrates their patient valor and still unending generosity, it reminds its readers that not the storm Katrina itself wrecked the city, but three kinds of human failure: shoddy army engineering, police repression at the time of the storm, and federal incompetence and indifference. The consequences of the storm exposed the venality of the present administration in Washington, leading to the sacrifice of the lives and well-being of thousands of citizens, and once and for all discrediting its own authority. Now, to rebuild New Orleans is to renew America. Anthologies of art and literature on occasion of catastrophe aren't unusual, but from the beginning, collections of photographs of Katrina's aftermath and written descriptions of the city have pointed up the storm's extraordinary destruction and the government's inadequate response. Coming in off the Gulf as a Category 3 hurricane, but striking as a Category 5, breaching four major levees, flooding 80% of the city with 20 feet of water, drowning 1,600 people and causing the deaths of several hundred more, Katrina was a natural catastrophe the federal government refused to be prepared for, and the local government proved unable to handle. This book celebrates the residents who withstood the floodwaters and the volunteers who saved them, the Cajun Navy, white boat owners who kept going into flooded areas, particularly the Lower Ninth, to bring people out even as authorities were stacking cars on the Crescent City Connection Bridge to block entrance into a predominantly white area and firing guns over the crowds. Eventually, most residents did get out. Many, however, didn't or couldn't return.
By winter 2007, the city that had close to 500,000 population had shrunk to 187,000. Blacks, who had outnumbered whites 2-1, were now a 10-9 minority. As Bill Quigley reported, New Orleans now has a much smaller, older, whiter, and more affluent population. Shockingly, even the online search engine Google Incorporated has joined the effort to pretend that the consequences of the storm don't exist, as if there had never been a storm, by replacing maps of the devastated areas with pre-August 29, 2005 maps. In fact, as the Associated Press states, entire neighborhoods are now slab mosaics where houses once stood, and shopping malls, churches, and marinas are empty of life and often gone entirely. The Times-Picayune recently revealed that the maps showing the wetlands buffer south of the city are 75 years out of date, that the marsh erodes at the rate of nearly 1.5 million square feet a day, and that scarcely 10 years remain to save any of it. Facts contradict the map's visual lying, and so do the words of these poems. Rebecca Solnit's Unstable Foundations, Letter from New Orleans, tartly summarizes what happened and what is happening. Despite the failure of every level of government, from the Bush administration and its still barely functional FEMA to the Louisiana bureaucracy with its red tape-strangled Road Home program to the city government, people are doing it for themselves. In New Orleans, the disaster that was Katrina was a storm, a flood, and an urban crisis. It's not even half over. The Ninth Ward symbolizes the abandonment of African Americans by the government in a time of dire need, and bringing it back is a way of redressing that national shame and the racial divide that went with it. But if it does come back, Solnit points out, it will be residents and outside volunteers who do it. The big question, will solidarity among anti-racist whites outweigh the lurking racism that surfaced in Katrina? Whether tens of thousands of citizens and even the city itself will be able to get money from the Army Corps of Engineers to cover losses resulting from the levee's breaches is moot. A long list of claims was filed by the March 1 deadline. But resolution depends on U.S. District Judge Stanwood Duval's ruling, whether the Corps, which has immunity from lawsuits stemming from its flood control projects, has immunity with regard to problems following from navigation projects. If the 17th Street Canal is adjudged a navigational waterway, like the MRGO, then the Corps wouldn't be immune from suits over damage done by flooding from it. St. Bernard Parish has already filed suit against the Corps to shut the MRGO, build the levees, and rebuild the coast. But all that will come only after the long march through the courts. Meanwhile, conditions in the city are fine for some and terrible for others. Visitors to New Orleans, Bill Quigley says, can still stay in fine hotels and dine at great restaurants. But less than a 5-minute drive away lie miles of devastated neighborhoods that shock visitors. Locals call it the Grand Canyon effect. You know about it. You've seen it on TV. But when you see it in person, it can take your breath away. Predominantly white parishes are restricting rentals and rebuilding to exclude poor blacks. Many migrant workers who have come for recovery jobs live in cars or tents. Those who own property are keeping out those who don't. The line is drawn on race and class. All public schools on the unflooded side of the Mississippi were immediately turned into charter schools. Blacks are forced into the lower half of a makeshift system of state and local schools. Two federal civil rights actions in January forced the state to abolish a waiting list for entry into public schools that kept hundreds of kids out for weeks. The main public health care provider, Charity Hospital, which saw 350,000 patients a year, is closed. Some people have to travel 85 miles for care, and the hundreds of thousands who lost jobs after Katrina lost health care as well. Daycare is scarce. Bus service has been reduced 83%. Part of the city is tormented by crime and by incompetent or actually criminal police. Some people are literally forgotten in jail. Quigley reminds us, crime is not the cause of a city dying. Crime is the sound of a city dying. He then also reminds us the connections between the lack of resources for Katrina rebuilding and Iraq and Afghanistan are clear to everyone on the Gulf Coast. Restoring New Orleans is crucial to America's recovery because the city is a port and major tourist attraction, because its houses with their ironwork and gingerbread are lovely, because the streets are poetically named and so much popular American music comes from them, and because it's a capital city for black culture that derived from Africa and rose without regard to capitalism. As Solnit puts it simply, if New Orleans doesn't recover, we aren't likely to either. Some people are helping every day, like Mrs. Deborah South Jones and her volunteers who drive into New Orleans East to dish out hot food and groceries to people in need. In the past 18 months, they have given out over 3 million pounds of food to more than 130,000 families. We look forward to the day, concludes Bill Quigley, a Loyola University law professor, when she will not have to feed us, when we will not need volunteers to gut and fix up our homes, when we can feed ourselves in our own fixed-up homes in a revitalized New Orleans. May that vision come true.
This is Catherine Hastings. I'm going to split off now from that program that was recorded with the poet F.D. Reeve in June of 2008. On that original program, I aired some local poets reading poems that had to do with Hurricane Katrina. But this is a tribute show for F.D. Reeve. So what I'm going to do now is play a number of cuts from his CD, The Blue Cat Walks the Earth. These are all poems written and performed by F.D. Reeve, and they are set to jazz. So sit back now and enjoy The Blue Cat Walks the Earth with F.D. Reeve.
Like the cat who walks by himself, the blue cat is still walking the earth. One of the first people he met was a holy fool, whose prophetic vision astonished the cat. The holy fool gives free advice.
Bad weather. Grief gatherers mass in the greenhouse. Their feathers dip and sway like tropical leaves.
Who knows what you know, says the cat. Is it make-believe? Madmen sting the air with noise like a swarm of bees. The fool.
Skulls on the beach. Fleas in wet sand. Gold flakes fall from the deciduous stars. Break then the salt hours like pearls. Fish in the trees. Stiff, fat, like pears.
The cat.
Cast the bones, doctor. The sea is in uniform. Alma, I fly.
The fool.
Train long gone. Nebulae of ants muster in space. March across the whites of God's eyes.
Daily life seems quiet, usually consolingly so, but the cat reminds us of its temptingly ever-present ambiguities. The cat's philosophy, or having your cake and eating it too. Outdoors, the air is blue with cold, the last apples are frozen. All day the kitchen waits folded like napkins for dinner music, footsteps, and the curtain of steam that rises on the evening life. A sequence of small acts ensues, some prepared, some spontaneous. Then comes the dessert, wild, unreserved, the climactic understatement. Making love is like painting a face on both sides of a window.
Cats are nice, but not genteel. Sometimes, some instances of politeness go too far. The apology. The cafe serves late breakfast, lunch, and tea. It's open every day from 10 to 3. Today, the cafe is closed. Sorry for the inconvenience. The things museum keeps of historic note are there for you to value by modern vote. Temporarily closed for refurbishment. Sorry for the inconvenience. There's a hole in the lane because they're digging again to repair last year's relayed water mains. Road closed, local access only. Sorry for the inconvenience. In Baghdad, girls, well-dressed, still alive, run down the steps where mortar shells killed 5. School closed until further notice. Sorry for the inconvenience. The fighting raged through the night as the sun rose over the desert. The dead and the half-burned town. It turned out all the streets were closed. Sorry for the inconvenience. Warm weather melts the polar ice. Great storms toss containers on the sea. Fish swarm, not bees. Farms are gone. Mortgages foreclosed. Sorry for the inconvenience. When the cat sets out tomorrow, I bet there'll be a new sign floating on the sea. Earth forever closed. Sorry for the inconvenience. You know how on a city street, if one person stops and looks up, everyone else does too? What do cats see? Envy, imagining the life of a bird. High overhead, I see a wild hawk skate figure eights on a pure glass sky. Then down, down he pirouettes and peels shoulder first through space with a human cry. Of course, cats always get what they want. Sometimes, however, they scorn what's offered, as the blue cat declined the temptations of public office. Cruel how the faithful set limits to the soul. Why not torture the lecherous owl that tears the mouse apart and swallows the moth? Why not boil the firefly, semaphoring its passion atop the hay? Why not castrate the lover ermined with old age? Violence, like a habit, suits popular behavior. A small red spider jigging on a thread baits the horny imagination. In the outhouse shadows, a girl's golden head dances under the full moon, abused, translucent, at dawn invisible. No trespassing without shame. The cat watches followers in the crowd shift like flies on a window, black bodies leaping up at the sun. Nowadays, everyone uses ballpoints and cartridges and toner. But do you remember the bottles of washable ink? Anyway, here's how the blue cat got another diploma. The cat advances to a higher degree. On dit is how the French begin when they want to skip original sin. The Russians use impersonal verbs as bland as homeopathic herbs. In Rome, one does as Romans do. With rats, one screws or gets screwed. These days, in the reign of rats, all failures fall on raghead cats. The only way to duck the blame is to become a famous name. Did rats swear alien aviation brought down the pillars of the nation, then send cats forth from the polyhedron for peace, security, and freedom? Though kittens starved and thousands died and half the great Euphrates dried? To counteract the primal liars, the blue cats set out to climb higher. The stars above the wealthy dominion like horoscopes shape public opinion, and each acolyte in the church of power aspires to be the cat of the hour. But justice and equality have become commodities. So a cat with a sheepskin PhD can buy and sell celebrities. No animal on earth so wise as the great blue cat with great blue eyes, in whose workshop on the wall hangs a diploma mailed out last fall. He submitted a form and a money order to a faith-based college near the border. 10 days later, got a scroll to keep and tiger-eyed the CEO of the heap, purveyor of catnip, pilot-in-chief, keeper of mouse traps, pope of belief, thought to himself, if we don't lead, we'll be led. If we trust in one great leader, we're lost. So he cried, rebels all, alive or dead, empower the young, let them become boss. Abandon all parties not morally true, and vote yourselves in permanent blue.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to a number of cuts from F.D. Reeves' CD, The Blue Cat Walks the Earth. This was a tribute show for him. He passed away in June of this year. Today, September 18th, would have been his 85th birthday, and I know that his wife, Laura Stevenson, spent it with a number of good friends, also paying tribute to F.D. Reeves. Now pull out your calendars, because the Word Temple Poetry Series is coming back to the Sebastopol Center for the Arts on Saturday, September 21st, when Philip Terman, author of The Torah Garden, as well as several other collections, will be visiting us from Pennsylvania. And Iris Jamal Dunkel will be reading from her debut poetry collection, Gold Passage. And last but not least, Dave Setter will be reading as our opening poet that night, Saturday, September 21st, 7 p.m., Sebastopol Center for the Arts. You can go to wordtemple.com for more information. Meanwhile, I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. and feel free to contact me with any questions or comments. Thanks for listening.